Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu. You're listening to Chronicles and Commons. This is the second in the Vampire mini-series, so last week I covered The Vampire, A Tale, by John Polidori, and this week I want to talk about Vikram and the Vampire by Richard Francis Burton. So Richard Francis Burton was a world traveler in the late 1800s. The book that I'm referring to now, Vikram and the Vampire, was published in 1870 or 1893, something in that time frame. I'm not quite clear on it because I've gotten one date from one thing, and then the book itself that I had, the copy, has a preface dated 1893, so I'm not sure if that's just a second edition or what. But that late 1800s, just before the 1900s. And one of his things that he did was he would hear local tales from the people that he would meet in faraway lands and translate them and publish them and sell them to the English-speaking audience. So Vikram and the Vampire is taken from a larger work from just Indian folklore, I guess. It was originally, from what I'm understanding, written in Sanskrit, and then it was translated locally into a more everyday common tongue, and then Richard Francis Burton came across it and translated parts of it into English. I mean, he may have translated all, but what was published were a series of 11 stories, and I'll explain why there are a series of stories within this work, but originally it was 25. So the framework for these tales, it's a little bit like the Arabian Nights, I suppose, in a sense, because the larger framework is about one thing, and then each story that you're actually reading throughout most of the work is entirely self-contained and completely about something different. So the bigger story is of Vikram and the Vampire, or the Batel, as it is spelt or sort of known in India. The Batel in Indian folklore was a kind of giant beast, or I shouldn't say giant, I mean it was a giant bat-like beast, so it's human size, but if you're talking about bats and things like that, then it would be giant. And they hang upside down, these batels, they hang upside down on a cirrus tree, S-I-R-A-S tree, or any tree maybe, but the one in this book was in a cirrus tree. I don't know what cirrus is, but that's where he was hanging out. And Vikram, a local famous king of the region, a raja of the region, he was well known, he was well liked, he was known for his strict rule and his harsh judgment, but fair judgment. He would have no pity on criminals, whether they were men or a man or a woman. It didn't matter. He didn't care. Everyone was, you know, was equal across the board, and so he was well liked. He was a very popular raja, and at some point in his career, Raja Vikram came across a man standing by a river who was about to perform a ritual that would grant him the powers, all the eight powers of nature. Didn't really explain what those were, but that's what he was doing. And he bade Raja Vikram to help him, to aid him. And Vikram says, sure, why not? It's actually it's really an easy sell. He doesn't have to convince the guy at all. He just says, hey, you, king, come help me gain all eight powers of nature. And the king's like, yeah, I can do that. So he goes over and tries to assist this guy. And the guy says, well, what you have to go do is go capture this batel from a tree where he's hanging out and bring him to me so that I can sacrifice him, something like that. And so Vikram goes to do that. Vikram and his son go to do that, and they very promptly capture the beast. The beast is pretty horrific. It is bat-like, apparently. It is a creature that can inhabit the dead bodies of other creatures, so it's not super clear whether the beast as it is becomes incorporeal and goes into into a dead creature and makes them undead, or whether that beast's current form is undead. I wasn't super clear on that, and I imagine that if I was more familiar with just the folklore, then I would probably know. But Vikram captures the Battel and starts walking back to wherever this wizard happens to, you know, wherever he left the wizard. But the Battel has a different idea, and this idea is that the Battel will tell Vikram a story, and at the end of the story, the stories will end with a little bit of a riddle or a puzzle, really. And at the end of each story, if Vikram is able to solve the puzzle and speaks that solution aloud to the Battel, then the Battel gets to leave and go back to his Cirrus tree. If Vikram is stumped, then the creature will continue to go with him. Now, you might think, well, why doesn't Vikram just pretend to be stumped? And that's not answered in Burton's version, but according to Wikipedia, in other versions, the deal is actually this, that Vikram can be stumped to keep the Battel. He can answer truthfully, and the Battel will go away, will be free. Or, if he knows the answer but doesn't speak it aloud, then his head will explode. Not the Battel's head, Vikram's head. So those were the choices. So he could stay silent, and if he knew the answer, then his head would explode. He could speak up and free the Battel, or he could speak up and be wrong and get to keep the Battel. So that was the deal, apparently, in the Indian, in the actual stories. Although, as I say, in Burton's version, it's just the two. So the stories, the 11 stories that I read, and again, there are actually 25 apparently, but I didn't know that. I didn't know that there were other versions. I mean, I still don't know that there are other versions, but I'm not going to reread other versions. I feel like I got enough out of this to go on. And that's largely because most of the stories, well, none of the stories are about a vampire, which after 235 pages, or whatever it was on my ebook reader, that came as something of a surprise to me. I had expected a lot more vampire and a lot less just general Indian folklore. That said, it was super interesting. So if you have any interest in Indian folklore, then you should check this book out, because it's at times charming, surprising, horrifying. It's really, really interesting. It was a good read, but you cannot look at the title and think that it has any bearing on what you are going to experience throughout the book. Because the only time you see the vampire, or Vikram for that matter, are between the stories for maybe, you know, five or six lines here, five or six lines there. At the end of each story, Vikram just can't help himself. He's a very braggadocio kind of guy. He thinks very highly of himself, I believe, and he's pretty famous and popular. So he just he's been sitting on a throne for a decade, you know, passing judgment over people. So this is what he does. So at the end of each story, he answers. He solves. He either solves the puzzle or elucidates, you know, something about the story or whatever. And each time the Battel, the vampire, runs away back to his tree, and then Vikram and his son have to go back to the tree to fetch the vampire again. So then they start off again, and it's that 11 or 25 times, depending on which version you read. So a lot of the stories have nothing of any kind of great interest, to be honest. There's one which I thought was kind of interesting, where there's a magical pill that causes the person who takes it to switch genders, and I got that basically that it's we say they said the book it said it was a pill, but I'm getting from the text that you don't swallow the pill, you just kind of, you know, set it in your mouth, you know, between your gum and your lip or something like that, and when you want to switch back to male or female or whatever you started out as, you can take the pill out of your mouth and you switch back. So it's a gender swapping pill, and this character in one of the stories, I think that might have been the eighth story or so, gets the gets this pill and uses it to swap back and forth to get ahead in life. It's pretty funny. And then there's another story about the ninth story is it's a story about a woman whose husband dies, and so does a soldier. They both die, and their heads are both cut off. So she encounters a magician in the jungle or the swamp or something, and he gives her some pieces of string, and says, if you tie these strings around a wound, then these magical strings will heal that wound. So she decides that she'll use this string to restore the men who have died before her to life. So she takes the head of her husband and sticks it back on his body and ties the string around his neck and does the same for the soldier, and they both wake up, but they wake up and they seem very, very confused. And at first you think they're confused because their souls have left their bodies, and that is something that the magician in the jungle who gave her the string in the first place specifically said. He said you can revive someone, return someone to life, even though their souls have gone on to the celestial plane or whatever. So you think that's why they're confused, but then it turns out at the end or you know, towards the end of the story, of the ninth story, that actually what happened was that in her haste to revive these two men, she accidentally put her husband's head on the soldier's body and the soldier's head on her husband's body. And so now both of them kind of feel like they have a claim over her, because the husband's head says, well, that's my wife, but the husband's body, through the head of the soldier, says, no, it's my wife. And so there's a little bit of a mix-up there. Those are the only two stories, honestly, that really stood out at me. I mean, all of them were interesting from a cultural perspective, because I really don't know a whole lot about India, to be honest, but they in terms of vampire research, not very useful. In the end of the story, though, we get a little bit more time with the Battelle and Vikram and his son, and it is genuinely an exciting part of the book. It really is. It's if you don't want spoilers, fast forward a bit, because it's such a good part that I have to sort of talk about it, because there's not a whole lot else to talk about, as you've seen. So when the Battelle leaves Vikram, he tells Vikram that the body that he'd been inhabiting was a child who Chantal Shill, the man who sent, the magician guy who sent Vikram on the quest in the first place, was actually planning on making a sacrifice of both this child and Vikram himself, and that Chantal Shill was hoping to have Vikram bow before his goddess, and as he bowed, he was going to decapitate him. So the Battelle leaves the body, so the grotesque form that the Battelle had sort of taken somehow leaves, and the child, the body of the Battelle reverts back to just being a normal child, a human child, dead, but a normal-looking child, not a bat-like creature or whatever it's supposed to be. I wasn't really clear. Descriptions aren't super great in the book. But the Battelle leaves and reminds Vikram that it's not a crime to kill if it's not a crime to kill someone who intends to kill you. So Vikram returns and drops off the body of this slain child that he retrieved. But when he returns, he comes to find that Chantal Shill, the magician, is surrounded by a horde of foul beasts, monstrous asuras, giant goblins, rakshasas, messengers of Yama, fierce and hideous, assumed at pleasure the shapes of foul and ferocious beasts. Nagas and bhutas, partly human and partly bestial, disported themselves in throngs about the upper air and were dimly seen in the faint light of the dawn. Mighty datyas, brahma datyas, and pretas, the size of a man's thumb, were dried up like leaves. The pisashas of terrible power guarded the place. There were enormous goats vivified by the spirits of those who had slain Brahmins, things with bodies of men and faces of horses, camels, and monkeys, hideous worms containing the souls of those priests who had drunk spirituous liquors, men with one leg and one ear, and mischievous blood-sucking demons who in life had stolen church property. There were vultures, wretches that had violated the beds of their spiritual fathers, restless ghosts that had loved low-caste women, shame on them, shades for whom funeral rites had not been performed, and who could not cross the dread Vaitarani stream, and vital souls fresh from the horrors of Tamrissa, or utter darkness, and the Usupatra Vana, or the sword-leafed forest, pale spirits, alias, gumas, batals, and yakshas, beings of a base and vulgar order, glided over the ground among corpses and skeletons animated by female fiends, dakinis, yoginis, hakinis, and shankinis, which were dancing in frightful revelry. The air was filled with supernatural sight and sounds, cries of owls and jackals, cats and crows, dogs, asses and vultures, high above which rose the clashing of the bones, which the yogi sat drumming upon a skull before him, shouting repeatedly, "Ho Kali, Ho Durga, Ho Devi." So that's what they come back to. And they still deliver the body of the child. No problem. Here's your dead child that you're going to sacrifice to your goddess. Nothing strange about this whatsoever, right? Now, Shantashil doesn't seem to feel like there's any rush either. And he actually has Vikram and Vikram's son, I think Dharma or something, Darva, hang around and continue to help with the ritual, because I guess they said they would, so he's taking them up on it. So they passed over the threshold and looked over into the gloomy inner depths. This is at a temple, the temple of the goddess that Shantashil is sacrificing to. There stood Shmashana Kali, the goddess, in her most horrid form. She was a naked and very black woman, with half-severed head, partly cut and partly painted, resting on her shoulder, and her tongue lolled out from her wide, yawning mouth. Her eyes were red, like those of a drunkard, and her eyebrows were of the same color. Her thick, coarse hair hung like a mantle to her heels. She was robed in an elephant's hide, dried and withered, confined at the waist with a belt composed of the hands of the giants whom she had slain in war. Two dead bodies formed her earrings, and her necklace was of bleached skulls. Her forearms supported a scimitar, a noose, a trident, and a ponderous mace. She stood with one leg on the breast of her husband, Shiva, and she rested the other on his thigh. Before the idol lay the utensils of worship, namely, dishes for the offerings, lamps, jugs, incense, copper cups, conches, and gongs, and all of them smelt of blood. For the time, for 1870, I think that's one of the most graphic depictions of any sort of horror type of scene that I've ever read from that time period. Nothing more gruesome than that comes to mind. The descriptions of the type of evil that is surrounding this evil priest or magician is evocative, and it's exciting, and frankly, it's probably a lot better than anything. Well, it's better than anything about the vampire itself in this book. But like I say, the vampire really isn't the central character in this book. He's just a vehicle for all of these parables. In terms of actual vampire lore that we could extract from this book, there's not a whole lot. But I think there is two significant things. The idea that a vampire could, or a Batel, can possess people. I think there is some precedence for that in other vampire lore that we see from Bram Stoker, for instance. But not quite like the Batel. I feel that the Batel really is much more sort of like just a possessive spirit, whereas in other vampire lores, there are oftentimes senses of there being, you know, sort of a puppet master, or the vampire has control over someone's will, but you don't get the feeling that the vampire itself is just a spirit that can then possess a vessel and distort it physically, and then when the spirit leaves, the distortion leaves, and the vessel becomes dead again. So it's really like super intelligent zombie creatures, I guess, that are distorted and evil looking, possessed by this evil vampire spirit. Now, the other thing about the lore that we can get is that the Batel is a trickster, which I think, again, is that's kind of a new idea. I mean, it's not a brand new idea. It's just nothing that I've ever seen really exploited anywhere else. Now, I remember the 90s. I lived through the 90s, and I had lots of friends into vampires in the 90s, you know, people reading Anne Rice and True Blood and other vampire, you know, whatever was hot at the time. But I don't really remember there ever being a famous trickster vampire character. I think that's a unique twist on the vampire idea, and I think that could be an interesting idea to exploit in a game or in something that you're writing or whatever, a tarot card that you're designing, you know, whatever it might be. The trickster vampire, I think, could be an interesting foe where they're not necessarily after creating new spawns or even necessarily after this unquenchable thirst for blood, and they're just after chaotic evil, or maybe they're just after getting a new and better host, or who knows what their goal might be. But it's kind of an interesting twist on things to make that vampire character just a trickster. That's about all I have to say about this book, I think. As I said in the beginning, it was an interesting book. I wouldn't necessarily discourage anyone from reading it. I found it quite fascinating. But don't read it as a vampire book, or you will be sorely disappointed. But there's a lot of evocative descriptions of horror at the end. There's really interesting cultural stuff in the middle, and some interesting folklore sprinkled throughout. That's about it for this episode. Thanks for listening, and I will talk to you next time. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.